The race is on, and it's going to be on again for Fernando Alonso in F1 next year, with confirmation that he'll drive for Renault, attempt to recapture those past glories when he won those two world championships that he's somehow failed to add to in the intervening years. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me for this special edition of the Race F1 Podcast Extra is Mark Hughes. Mark, you're still camped out in Austria in the heat, the excessive heat by the sounds of it, but at least you've had this news to keep you busy.
Yeah. Delighted to have to churn out loads more words in between these three Grand Prix and three weekends. It's great news. I think it is anyway. It's something that seems to have split a lot of fans. Quite a divisive character as always. I'm quite excited by it, and I've been waiting for it. I wasn't surprised by it. It's just, for me, it was a case of when it was going to be made official. Great stuff.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's not quite the right team for him, really, but it's the only team that's available of that level. So, you know, if he wants to get back into it, he's got to do it. So that's why it makes sense from that perspective. But that point you make about him being divisive, let's just start there in general terms. I almost feel like Alonso has become this pantomime figure, hasn't he? Which I think is a little bit unfair, really, because he's a high quality driver. Yes, he's had his problems. Yes, he hasn't always made the perfect decisions and conducted himself in the perfect way. But he's an outstanding driver. He does incredible things behind the wheel, and that's what really, really matters, isn't it? We've got a great driver back in Formula One. What's not to like?
Yeah, exactly. He's the pantomime villain. I think that's probably the best way of describing him, as far as the fan base is concerned. And some love him and some hate him. People have this picture of him as some aggressive character that's going around upsetting everybody and stomping his feet. He's not at all like that. He'll just occasionally say things which are difficult for the... when it was at McLaren, it was Honda, wasn't it? The famous, infamous GP2 engine comment. That, you know, he could make life easier for himself if he didn't do that. But if you talk to the people he's actually working with, the engineers and the people around, they think he's fantastic. He's not divisive in the sense that he creates a horrible atmosphere in the garage or anything like that. His level of performance that he brings sort of puts a tension in, I guess, that, you know, the rest of the team feels it needs to measure up. But there's nothing wrong with that. It's especially if you're an ambitious team making progress on the way up, which is how Renault sees itself. So that, I think it dovetails quite nicely. It was probably the most realistic, the only realistic place left from to go. But by the same token, I think he's by far the best choice of those who are available on the market that Renault could have taken to replace Ricciardo.
I don't think they're either side's first choice, should we say. Renault ideally would like a Hamilton or a Verstappen. Of course, it can't have that. Alonso would love to be in a Mercedes or a Red Bull, but that's not an option. But this is the kind of best available marriage that's available for the two of them. And I think, yeah, the whole... Alonso does have a specific way he likes to do things. You could probably say he could perhaps be a little bit more malleable in the way he works with people. But these are, like you say, it's not like he just wreaks havoc the second he walks through the door or anything. He's a very, very good driver with a very clear objective. And I think the interesting thing is, there's no question he can still do it. This is very different. That the obvious comparison is the Michael Schumacher comeback, isn't it? Which didn't go as hoped, although I'd argue his performance level was better than people give it credit for. But Alonso's been racing. He's been racing at a very high level and succeeding, racing for Toyota, won the Daytona 24 Hours as well in another program. So he's sharp, he's determined, he's focused. He's not had 3 years not really competing as Schumacher did. So he is still current in that regard. Yeah, age is against him. Not even Alonso can completely disregard the effects of age. But there's no reason why he can't do what he's always done.
No, I agree. And I think in terms of the physiological effects on lap speed, I think are... of age on lap speed, I think are generally overstated at this sort of age anyway. I think it's more to do with desire and motivation. You don't have many case studies to base it on, because drivers tend to retire before they get to this age, but not usually because they've got slow, usually because they felt they've either achieved what they want to achieve, the level of success, or they've not quite cut it and the system's rejected them. So there's very few actually get to choose to stay at this age. And I think there are enough case studies through the years where you can say, well, if the guy's committed and motivated enough and has continued to compete, hasn't sort of taken time out and then not competed, then the speed stays for quite a long time beyond 40.
Although there is some deterioration at that age, it's trivial at that stage. Ultimately, it's just not a thing that's going to make you 10% slower or anything. It can easily be counterbalanced by experience and that determination. And the one thing you can't doubt about Fernando Alonso is how determined he is to win that third world championship. Make no mistake, that's why he's come back. And I believe he'll see Renault as a team that perhaps could make it happen. They could come through, but he'll also see it as a chance to kind of refresh his reputation and say, look, I can still do it. I'm relevant. I'm up to date. I can still do the job. So if Renault doesn't work, he at least still kind of refreshes his possible value as a spare top line driver to a top team, which may be a bit of a long shot, but it still keeps that door open, doesn't it, to winning that third world title?
Yeah, and I think realistically, is he going to win another world title? I don't believe he will. I think in the time scale that he has left, I don't think Renault is going to be at the level that they're going to need it to. But I think they'll every chance of getting to the level where they can be real factors from race to race, without maybe putting a campaign together to win a title. But they're definitely going to. I can't see any reason why they wouldn't be factors and an exciting addition to the field.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's still unlikely, but it's unlikely rather than no chance at all. And I guess that's the real key. And for Renault, they will get a driver who will haul that car around and really drag the lap time out of it. We did, for example, we saw the value of that at the weekend. Esteban Ocon was a bit undercooked, so I don't think he's quite shaken the rust off yet. We know how good he is, but Daniel Ricciardo, there were moments when he pulled some really good performance out of the Renault in Austria, and that there is a value to having a driver who can do that. It sounds like stating the obvious, but if you've got a driver, you can put in the car, and he will extract something approaching the best out of it, not only over a single lap, but over race stints. We know how relentless he is. Then that has huge value, because it can add up to actually a hell of a lot of performance in terms of your results over a season.
Yeah, that's right, he will. You'll be able to benchmark where you're at. And also, I think you will also be able to benchmark where Alonso's at. Not that I think there's any question about that, but the fans will be able to benchmark it, because you have a quality driver alongside him, full of ambition with everything yet to achieve. So I think that intra-team competition is going to be quite tasty. I don't think it'll have any particularly nasty edge. They seem to be reasonably friendly, and I think they will together. That competition will be the constructive sort that drives the whole thing forward, rather than the destructive type.
Yeah, Esteban Ocon obviously made some positive comments about Alonso last week. Obviously, he probably knew this was coming, because we all kind of had a reasonable idea at the range it was happening. But I don't think. Again, Alonso, in terms of he wants to be the lead driver in a team, but generally his relationships with teammates haven't been as bad as projected. Even with Lewis at McLaren, which was the most fractious moment of Alonso's career, ultimately, it wasn't like it was like we see with some driver pairings when it was kind of complete all-out war. There were war moments, weren't there? Hungary, for example. But again, I think it's this misapprehension that he'll just instantly go in and start kind of almost punching his teammate or something, which just isn't really what happens. Yeah, he'll want to assert himself, and he'll be quite aggressive in trying to do that. But again, it doesn't mean it has to be counterproductive for a team like Renault.
No, exactly. And I think you saw his relationship with Jenson Button at McLaren, who was very good, very healthy. And even before that, with Philippe Massa at Ferrari, I mean, it wasn't a buddy-buddy sort of relationship, but it was completely professional, and they rubbed along just fine. So, yeah, I think that part is overstated. I think even the McLaren first time around with Hamilton, the relationship breakdown was essentially between Alonso and Ron Dennis, not between Alonso and Hamilton. They remained fine. And subsequent to him leaving McLaren, they even probably improved. So, yeah, I really don't think that's going to be an issue. I think the fact that both Alonso and the Renault team are essentially fighting for their long-term, or for the survival in Formula One, really, long-term in the sense of Renault, in the case of Renault. I think there's going to be a feeling of they are very much in this together, more so than when he, say, joined Honda, where they, I think it was more that they felt they could enjoy some success together. It was misplaced, as it turned out. But this is more of a fight where you have to join forces with someone and to make sure that you both come out of it. And I think this is, I think that'll be the vibe that marks this partnership third time around.
It's one of those things, isn't it, that the capacity for it to go wrong is what everyone focuses on, isn't it? And yes, Renault, the past, say, 18 months for that team haven't really gone perhaps as hoped. The season didn't start stunningly, but it didn't start terribly. And I think there's a fair bit more to come in that car. It wasn't a straightforward weekend for them. So there is the hope that Renault can kind of kick on. But obviously the thing people fear is that the Renault will underachieve a little bit and Alonso will be running around making his GP2 engine comments, making his, oh, I drove a miracle lap and look how rubbish this all is, etc. And that this could be counterproductive. Because we did see, for example, last time around with Renault, there were a few, when he went there as a kind of stopgap, if you like, when he left McLaren waiting for something like Ferrari to come up. So he had a couple of years at Renault. And there were some times in those 2 years where he wasn't quite giving his best because he was a bit frustrated, and there were, if I remember, a few people working there, while they knew how good he was, they weren't necessarily completely happy with the way things had gone at all times. So I think that's the thing that people fear will happen. But you also get the positive, don't you? They had a lift from Ricciardo coming in. They've got a double world champion coming in. The guy who took Renault to the world championship twice last time round. So that's actually a positive galvanizing effect. And I feel it's one of those things that if it starts sort of well, by which I mean not winning races, but with decent results, it could kind of spiral upwards and just be one of those partnerships that really, really does work. So it feels like it could go either way to me. It could go superbly or it could go terribly or anywhere in between, which is a great story for Formula One.
Second time around at Renault, he was really just marking time. He knew he was going to Ferrari, but he had to stay in the game until that seat became available. And when the car was halfway there and had a chance, he was the fabulous Alonso that we'd seen first time around. But yeah, there were days where he was just didn't seem that interested in a car if it wasn't a contender. But I don't think we're going to see that this time. He can't afford to do that this time. And I don't think his motivation is going to, he's not going into it with the same mindset as he did then, which was really just marking time until I get the proper drive. This is the proper drive, and this is the thing he's got to make work.
Yeah, we should remember that with McLaren, he was driving at a high level. He had a few little moments, but you know, Baku, his drive there was fantastic in the hobbled car. And so, you know, there were consistently he was excelling and showing that he could do that in the midfield if he kind of felt he needed to make that sort of point. And I think this thing, I mean, obviously you mentioned that what you didn't think a world championship is very likely. I'd agree it isn't that likely, but it is the thing that drives Alonso, and he probably knows it's not that likely, but it's that kind of chance, isn't it, to kind of go for it. I think that third one is important to him because it would put him up there with, you know, Senna, and it would sort of make a point, wouldn't it? Because he could have, as he always points out, a few points here and there in key seasons, and he'd have another few world championships. Could have won 07, could have won 10, could have won 12. So there is that element of unfinished business as well to his career, which is why at this age, he turns 39 later this month. That's why he's not willing just to say, actually, I don't need to go back. That's why he's still got that drive and that determination, because he still feels there's success to be had, that not that he's owed, but that he's capable of getting. And of course he is, because he's an astonishing driver.
Yeah, you get the sense, for one who is at such a high level and has achieved what he's achieved, even if it falls short of what he could have achieved. And I think the stat that you were referring to there is 8 more points spread in the right seasons would have made him a 5-time world champion rather than a 2-time. So just a total of 8 more points in the crucial seasons. But it always struck me, like interviewing him and the comments he's made in public, that his legacy is very important to him, how people consider him. And if he feels he's not being rated as highly as he feels is justified, it bothers him, which is unusual for someone at that level, but it really does seem to bother him. And he does seem to like to prove the doubters wrong. And I think that's very much one of the factors that's driven him back into Formula One, even if it's not in the higher level a team as he might have hoped when he took that sabbatical.
Yeah, and he does refer to that legacy, as you say. I remember when he went to do Indy in 2017, he said that, well, if you want to be the greatest in Formula One, you've got to match or eclipse Michael Schumacher's number of world championships. Well, I'm not going to get 7 world titles, so instead I've got to succeed everywhere, if you like, which is why he targeted the Triple Crown. And, you know, for all the fact that he hasn't won Indy, I was at Indy in 2017, he was in contention to win. If the engine hadn't gone pop, you know, you can't say he would have won it. He would have had a shot, and he was being really impressive with what he was doing. So, yeah, he is aware of that. I think I've expressed my reservations about Alonso and Renault before, and I sort of stand by those elements of it, but I've always kind of wanted it to happen and him to come back. But we're privileged enough to stand trackside up close and watch these guys in action. What Alonso can do with a car is very, very rare. It's that combination of just incredible. He's incredibly quick, yeah, but the way he does it, it requires this combination of aggression, of car control, of being proactive, reactive. It's an amazing blend that he puts together to get that lap time. And I don't think there's very many people, I don't think there's been many racing drivers in history who could do what he does, the way he does it, that consistently, because he's relying so much on just that outrageous feel and reaction.
Yeah, he has a wonderful improvisational way with a car, and he can adapt to whatever it's doing. And you see it in action. You see him varying his approach from corner to corner, and even you know, as the track grip comes up, you'll see him, if you stand in trackside, you'll see him begin to do something in a different way as the traits of the tire evolve or whatever. And yeah, he's always looking for an edge. He's always looking. He's not locked into a particular way of doing something. He can always improvise whatever's best for that car in that moment. And he's quite extraordinary at that. And it doesn't, you know, you hear a lot of drivers. Kimi was one of them. Jenson Button was another one, where they say, "Well, I can't drive it to my best ability because it's not doing the right things, or these tires don't suit my driving style." Or you never hear that from Alonso, because that doesn't. It's not even a factor. He will just adapt, and he's got a massively broad bandwidth of car traits, and it really doesn't seem to matter where the car sits on that bandwidth.
No, absolutely. You could see that up against Van Dorn at McLaren. Sort of Van Dorn's a very capable driver, and I would like to see him have another crack at Formula One, because I think there's kind of a missed talent there. But Van Dorn was constrained by the limitations of the McLaren, whereas Alonso was able to kind of provoke it, to live with it, to improvise his way round the limitations and get what he could out of it, which you could see trackside very clearly. It was just remarkable. That's what I'm pleased to see. And I think even there will be people listening to this who hate Alonso, and that's fine. You don't have to be a fan of him. But I'd just say, just watch him and just enjoy what he does, because we will not will not see his like again, is I guess the cliche, isn't it? Because he is one of those once in a generation at best drivers, and I think we're very fortunate that we'll get another couple of years of him in Formula One. That's good for Formula One, good for Renault, good for Alonso, good for us. Even if it doesn't work out with the results, it's still a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, he's one of the special ones, and he's still got a lot of performance in him. And when you hear criticism of, he's had his shot, why doesn't he move over for youth? Well, that's down to the youth. The youth has got to be at a level where they're clearly going to deliver his level of performance. And there isn't, if you look at who Renault has available, who is available on the market for Renault to choose from, there's no one that you would say could come in and deliver an Alonso level of performance. Even an Alonso level now, after 2 years away, there just isn't anyone there at that level.
Well, having heard from Mark Hughes, I've got a bonus, because here's Scott Mitchell, who's fresh from a press conference with Cyril Abitbol and Fernando Alonso himself. So Fernando Alonso will obviously have laid out why he's chosen this path. So what is he saying?
Yeah, so Fernando is basically talking quite patiently. He says he's relaxed. He knows what 2021 has in store for him, which is a return to the F1 midfield he walked away from in 2018 with zero interest in continuing, because it's all eyes on 2022. So that was the message from Fernando and Cyril as well. They've got a clear target in mind. So Fernando has apparently bought into what Renault has to offer. He at least is willing to give it a go and thinks that they have what it takes to learn over the next 18 months and put it all into practice for 2022. So he sees 21 as like almost like a bonus season, a season of preparation. So I think it's fair to say that a lot of us are looking at it like he's a man who, you know, time is not on Alonso's side. He needs to get to the front of F1 as soon as possible. Whereas Fernando sort of looking at it and saying, well, I can't get to the front of F1 in 2021. I need to look at what my best option is to get there as quickly as possible. And in his eyes, that's Renault. He likes what he sees behind the scenes. And he did come across quite content in his decision, shall I say.
So how's it going to work now? How's he going to prepare for it? What's the schedule between now and pre-season testing next year?
He's going racing, but not in F1. He's got to do the Indianapolis 500, which obviously, as we know, is the best possible way for someone to prepare for their F1 comeback.
If he qualifies.
If he qualifies, of course. He will try to contest the Indy 500. It didn't go so well for him in 2019. But so basically, all joking aside, Indy 500 is Fernando's first priority. That is his program. Obviously, the rescheduled race happening in August. So Fernando's thrown himself into that. It's not like he can just pop over to Enstone and jump in the F1 simulator anyway because of the quarantine laws that exist in the UK. So it would be very difficult to manage that. So basically, Indy 500 prep for now, and then Fernando reckons that from September he will be able to focus properly on Formula One. And from what Cyril Abitbol is saying, that doesn't mean getting on track in FP1s. There was this sort of a very sensible theory rooted in logic that Renault can just kick out Daniel Ricciardo for a few FP1s before the end of the year, and then get Alonso sort of in the feel of this car, because this car will be the basis of the 21 car. That's not on Renault's agenda. Abitbol went as far as saying he doesn't see how that would be any benefit, although he did then throw to Fernando to say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and Fernando had a little bit of a smile. So maybe they will have a slight conversation about that, because Fernando is a stickler for preparedness.
Well, I think also, because we are seeing some FP1 drivers dropping in for the Red Bull Ring this weekend for the second race, and there's a good chance we'll see a back-to-back later in the season, isn't it? We might see one in Bahrain, for example. There's that option. So if there's a second one, that seems a golden opportunity, but that's not on the calendar yet.
No. It would seem foolish, I think, to not put Fernando in if contractually they are able to. I can't see why Ricciardo would have a contract that stipulates he has to do every single session, because I can't see that being a threat when they put that contract together. But maybe there is. But Cyril sort of seems to think, oh, that's not really a priority. It sounds like they haven't really discussed it properly. But I'm sure that's the sort of thing that Alonso would want to do, because while Abitbol might not see that as a benefit, Alonso's the kind of guy who just doesn't leave any stone unturned. So if he thinks, okay, here's an opportunity for me to to not just see firsthand by going to a Grand Prix what this team is like, but to actually be there in the middle of it and actually experience it and make some recommendations, fast track that process for the start of 2021. But if that isn't possible, if for whatever reason they don't want to, or they can't put Fernando in the car for an FP1 session driving the 2020 Renault, there is still the option of driving the 2018 car, and Abitbol didn't rule that out. He said that there's nothing firmly planned yet, but it is an option. They proved with their test before the Red Bull Ring opener that they're willing, they have the budget to put a 2018 car on track, make the use of the rules that allow testing with two-year-old machinery if they think there's a benefit. And what could possibly be a bigger benefit than making sure Fernando Alonso is up and running, fit and ready for 21?
It would seem prudent to take that option. Did he talk about the fact that he's an old man in Grand Prix racing terms? He'll turn 40 next year.
He did, actually. Let me find the exact quote, because it was very amusing. Basically, it's classic Alonso. Fernando is basically straight back into that, you know, talking himself up, talking the team up. He seems to be saying the right things, but he couldn't help but have a little bit of fun. So basically, as far as he's concerned, he's fitter than ever. He's better than ever. He says he's 100% ready to come back. He said he's just done a fitness test and he's had the best results he's ever had in his career. And how I've missed a Fernando. This is the best thing I've ever done, haven't you?
This is the best press conference I've ever done. I presume he said that.
But what he did say, he was asked directly, you know, the prospect of going up against much younger drivers. What do you think? And he said that for many years, the stopwatch is the only thing that matters. He said it's not the age. He says he's never had the classification of the race based on the passport date of birth. It's always based on time, which, you know, I can't fault his immediate logic.
Yeah, there's going to come a point where that's going to become a factor. But yeah, as I was discussing with Mark Hughes, we don't think that's going to be a problem, and he doesn't think it's going to be a problem. Obviously, how was the Fernando Alonso Cyril Abitbol double act working?
Oh, that's a good question, because you do have... That is a good question, because in the two of them, you have Fernando, who is like the master... What's the word? He's like the master manipulator of the media, isn't he? He knows, he loves to play the media. That's part of the game. And he can say all he likes that's not the stuff that he liked about Formula One. But he was very good at it. He knew how to use it to his advantage.
He was a master of answering a question so you knew what he thought without actually saying it, which is brilliant if you want to avoid trouble with the team.
And Cyril's not the opposite of that, but Cyril basically... You can see him constantly, he's desperately trying not to say what he thinks, but then he goes ahead and says it. And that I think can cause tension within the team. I think we saw it on the Netflix show on Drive to Survive last year or covering the 2019 season. These little comments that sort of, I think he's trying to make them as a joke, but you can see like he riled Nico Hülkenberg up with a comment about Nico not scoring a podium yet in Formula One and that sort of thing. And just goes down slightly worse, I think. He's just maybe just a bad communicator. So you've got Alonso, master communicator, and Cyril, who can do what I'm basically doing now, which is sort of lose track of what you're saying and get a bit rambly and then sort of accidentally say something you're not supposed to and maybe cause a bit of controversy. There wasn't any indication of like Fernando going, oh God, this guy, rolling his eyes or anything like that. Not at all. I would definitely not go so far as to try and read into their relationship from what I saw on the video call. It lasted maybe 20, 25 minutes or so, maybe a bit longer. So difficult to make a firm conclusion there, but you could tell that Cyril was massively, massively keen, and like he's very pleased to have got Alonso on board. And I think if Alonso's words about being relaxed are true, and he certainly did look relaxed there, I think he's probably in a place now in his life, especially after some time away, where I think this version of Alonso can fit this environment at Renault much better than the Alonso of a few years ago could.
Yeah, and also he knows this is the last shot this period of his F1 career, so he needs to make it work. There was also a bit of talk, I believe, about the whole Renault Driver Academy and the fact they've gone for experience over youth. We had quite a lot of people complaining on social media about them not going for a Guan Yu Zhou, a Christian Lundgaard. So what was their rationale for going down this route?
It basically comes down to circumstances. So Renault's initial intention with the academy was to have a driver in contention to drive for the team in 2021. Cyril said that was the plan. He didn't go so far as to say that they wanted to have one of the guys in their car in 21, because ultimately, if things have gone to plan, they'd have had Ricciardo and Ocon. So why would you bust one of those out to have Guan Yu Zhou or Christian Lundgaard in, for example? But he did say, Cyril, that he addressed that. He basically second-guessed the criticism that he's getting already for this. And he just said that he knows it can be seen as a lack of interest or loyalty of the project, but it isn't. He wants to be really clear that it isn't. It's basically a case of a driver like Fernando's available, coupled with the fact that the most senior people that they have on the academy program, Guan Yu Zhou and Christian Lundgaard, as I mentioned, their Formula 2 season hadn't started until last weekend because of the crisis and the impact that's had on various motorsport schedules. So they haven't been able to sort of start the season and show, yeah, look, we've made a step, like we are ready, or we look like we are ready, to at least put themselves in the conversation. So when you don't have drivers that have proven emphatically on track they're ready for F1, when you need to have drivers that have definitely got the super license and they can get some mileage in the F1 car, and you know that there's not going to be a season or two of training them up, it's a bit too much of a risk. And maybe if we'd got towards the end of 2020 and Joe was winning Formula 2, for example, or was second in Formula 2 but had put together a really good season and was just unlucky, maybe he'd have been a bit more in the frame. Certainly if there'd been a Charles Leclerc type, someone like that would definitely be more in the frame. And Abitbol basically says they are very, very serious about this, about these two in particular, so Joe and Lundgaard, and the plan is basically to see what they can do to facilitate their path into F1. So if Joe and Lundgaard have a stonkingly good 2020 season, I don't really see what Renault is going to be able to do, but it sounds like they are very, very keen to try and have at least an interim step, so to try and facilitate some kind of F1 action for them next year if they prove they deserve it.
Yeah, and of course we should say they've got Oscar Piastri coming up on the rails as well, the Formula One Euro Cup champion who won his F3 debut, so they've got another decent driver there. But overall, what's your impression of this? I mean, myself and Mark had the chance to talk about how enthusiastic we are about Alonso being right, even if the circumstances aren't necessarily absolutely perfect for both sides. From what you've seen, are you looking forward to it? Do you think this is... I mean, all these partnerships start off brilliantly, don't they? Nobody in their first press conference is going to start showing the cracks. The cracks haven't had a chance to start to form, let alone appear.
Yeah, exactly. So at the moment, it's all interesting. I am curious to see how it plays out. I'm looking forward to seeing how a guy like Alonso approaches the prospect of a comeback, because as I said earlier, he's such a stickler for detail. So that will be fascinating to follow. And then if he does get on track this year, I'd love it if we could see him in an FP1 just to see how he compares. That would be really, really interesting. And then when it comes to actually 2021, I mean, it's going to be a bit underwhelming, I think, next year, because either Alonso's going to be, you know, slightly off it at the beginning and needing some time, or he's going to be mired in the midfield anyway. So it's just going to be a little bit of a false dawn, I think, in 2021. And that's what I'm really curious in. I think that will be as big a determining factor in the success of this decision, because if Renault's really bad in 21, or there's something going on behind the scenes that suggests actually this was a bit of a mistake, I can see tensions starting to rise quite early in this partnership, because this is Alonso's last chance. So let's see how 21 goes, because there'll be an indicator of what's going on behind the scenes, and we'll get some noises, won't we, about how their development's going for 2022. This all rides on two things. It's Alonso being back and as good as we know he can be, and it's on Renault to do a better job than they've done in the last few years. We'll get an indicator long before they actually put the 2022 car on track. So I'm really looking forward to following that process, which starts today and runs all the way through to that, probably the first pre-season test of 2022, and seeing how that relationship develops, if it's good, or as you say, if the cracks start to appear.
Well, it's certainly a huge story. It's taken over F1 news this week, and it's all anybody's reading about or talking about or watching videos about. And as such, there's loads on therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen, looking into all sorts of different dimensions of this Alonso Renault move. There's a video on our YouTube channel, so if you look for The Race there, and then of course this podcast too, which you have listened to. And of course we'll all be flat out covering the Styrian Grand Prix this weekend. Mark Hughes on the scene, and myself and Scott Mitchell again, in a world of Zoom and WhatsApp messages to keep track of what's going on. Thanks for listening, and join us for our post-race review sometime in the small hours of Monday morning.